are listening to the Iran Election 1400 podcast, Intekhobat-e Iran Hazar-o Charsad, brought to you by the Middle East Studies Forum at the Alfred Deakin Institute, Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to the first episode of the Iran Election 1400 podcast. My name is Dr. James Barry, and I'll be hosting you over the next few weeks as we cover the Iranian presidential election campaign up to and beyond the election day on June 18. Through this weekly podcast, we will be bringing up all the relevant news and analysis of the election, and we'll be keeping up to date so that you don't have to. For the next few weeks, we'll have panel discussions covering the week's events, including both domestic and foreign policy issues, and we'll be profiling candidates and analysing their campaigns. We'll also bring you some in-depth interviews with analysts and activists and other actors surrounding this election. Today, our first podcast, we'll mainly be giving you the background to the election, explaining the procedure, personalities, and a bit about how we can characterise the Iranian political system. Joining me today is Dr. Nasser Ghobadzadeh, who is a senior lecturer at the Australian Catholic University and an expert on Iranian politics, political Islam, state religious relations, and secularism. Welcome, Nasser.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So to start off with, Nasser, how would you characterise Iran as a political system? What is the system like? What is the regime like?
Yeah, that's a very important question. I think that that's a very good question, actually, to start talking about the election in Iran, because I think that there is a confusion about the political system in Iran, and the confusion has been there for the last four decades from the time that the regime was established because of its peculiar system. I would say that the political system in Iran is more electoral authoritarian system. And unfortunately, even in the academic circle, it's not discussed. And it's quite new conceptualization, which is happening right now. I mean, there are a few articles, and I have seen a book at least about that, articulating Iran's political system as an electoral authoritarian system, or we would call it electoral theocracy.
So what characterizes electoral authoritarianism system?
Yeah, that's a quite new categorization of the political system, which happened after the Cold War era, when there was this hope that the whole world will turn to be a democratic system.
Francis Fukuyama view of the world.
Exactly. But later, the scholars of the democratization find out that there are many political systems which adopt electoral procedures, and they take the elections take place in those countries, but still the authoritarian nature of the countries or systems remains intact, and elections becomes a tool and an instrument in the hands of the authoritarian systems. There are many examples. Russia is a good example right now, that we see that the Putin is in charge for many years. Malaysia is a good example. Singapore is a good example of this. And I think Iran is one of those types of the regimes, but it is not included in the discussions about these types of the regime, because there is no party system as we know in the Western and there is no free press, and it's very, the manipulation of the elections is very open and blatant in Iranian system, rather than in Malaysia or in Singapore, even in Russia. And that's why they are not, I mean, discuss Iranian political system as an electoral authoritarian system.
Okay, because it's very interesting. I mean, the way I've always seen it, as someone who's been following Iran for a while and who's been there and lived there, is that it's like a one-party state in many cases. Like you said, there aren't political parties. Even though there are declared political parties, they're not political parties as we would understand them. But they're also political factions, which we'll talk a little bit about later, which also act as factions within one party, as in they all adhere to the same rules technically, and they are fighting each other in an election for who gets to have a say in what's happening in the next couple of years. Would that fit into the idea of a one-party state? Would that fit into this idea of a hybrid system?
Yes, but I wouldn't call it a one-party system. It's exactly one of the functions of the elections within this political system, which it gives the opportunity and an instrument to manage the factional conflicts within the system. Mm-hmm. And also elections provide the elites, and particularly the theocratic bodies, to somehow patronize their own client clientelist system that exists in Iran as well. And of course, claiming legitimacy, reinforcing legitimacy from time to time is a function of election within this system, which is somehow undermined by the particularly the oppositions. So by claiming that the election doesn't matter at all because mm-hmm. there is no big shift or it's not going to be leading towards democratization. But that's not the function of the elections in this system. The function of the elections is to help the authoritarian and the resilience of authoritarian in this regime rather than changing it to the democratization.
And does it help it? Would you say one of the issues that comes up every election is participation? So we're talking about it this time as well, that the number of people coming out to vote it's an issue for legitimacy. Now, there are certain parts of the regime that aren't for large participation. We know this from the Revolutionary Guards, which we'll talk more about, which are part of the armed forces, but a specific self-contained part of the armed forces. They have said in the past, through leaked audio, that large turnouts are bad for them. But this time, there is a fear that there's going to be a very negligible turnout because of COVID and other issues. And this is a threat to the legitimacy, because if people don't turn out to vote, that means that they're not voting for the Islamic Republic, in a sense. They're voting against it by not turning out. I mean, does this come back to this whole issue that the electoral system works for the authoritarian side?
Yeah, I think it matters a lot for the ruling clergy in Iran that the turnout rate should be higher than to have a showcase in the international community as well as against the opposition groups. But at the same time, we shouldn't forget that there has been few elections in which that the turnout rate has been very low. I mean, even in the parliament election, I think the seventh parliamentary election, after 2009, I think 2012, if I'm not mistaken, and there was just like 30% turnout in Tehran, something like that. And I don't think it will damage very seriously the regime and its legitimacy, because always there are a very, secured base of support for the regime. I think it's more the concern in the big cities like in Tehran, Tabriz, Shiraz, and those cities, but in the rural areas, in the smaller cities, they always has got their own base support of 40 up to the 50% votes that they always get. And I don't think that will matter a lot, because the higher turnout always comes with the risks. Mm-hmm. Like 2009 risks, like 1997, that it was risky again with the reformist era and all those things. And I don't think that the hardcore of the system, particularly those theocratic bodies, are interested of risking again with this sort of the high turnout.
One of the other issues is we get I get a lot of feedback on the Twitter page and through other emails about this election podcast. Can this be taken seriously as an election? I mean, is this an election? Now, compare this with what's happening in Syria at the moment. There's a presidential election happening in Syria at the moment, of course, which Iran is acting as a electoral supervisors of. Iran's system is a little bit peculiar compared to other systems like neighboring Syria because of that, because it does have the appearance of being more open. Now, people in Iran itself might disagree with that, but that is the point that comes up. And I guess that's why we're trying to run this podcast as well, is to give people a little bit of an insight into the various aspects of it. Now, just to move on to the president, for the importance of the president in most countries is that they're the head of state. In Iran, they're not. In Iran, they're almost like the acting day-to-day governing head of the government, but they're not the head of state. And this comes to what you're talking about with electoral authoritarianism, or the authoritarianism being a very mixed system in some ways. What would you say, just to the listeners, just explain to the listeners what the presidential system, what the president actually does and who they're accountable to?
Yeah, I think, that's one of the things about Iran, that the election matters. Mm-hmm. It matters not only about the parliament, but particularly about the president and the role that the president plays. I mean, president is the second in command in the executive body after the supreme leader, of course. He appoints all the cabinet members. He chairs the cabinet. He's the head of the Security Council. He's the head of the Council for the Cultural and Cultural Revolution. And he plays the most significant role in the, particularly in the day-to-day politics, the budget and all the policies. And Even in those areas which usually, I mean, they say that the president and the electoral bodies doesn't play any role, like in foreign policy, regional policies, in the nuclear negotiations, or in dealing in relation with the U.S. relations. I think it's a sort of simplifying issue, saying that the president and the electoral bodies doesn't play any role in those things, because one of the complexities of the system is that I think it doesn't work as a very purely authoritarian system. It's not one person making decisions. There is always internal negotiation, I guess. Mm-hmm. And president and the electoral bodies play a role in the negotiation with the supreme leader, with the theocratic bodies, and their input to the system matters. And I would, this is a good opportunity to highlight one of the key features of the seminary or the clerics culture within the clerics. You know that in Islam, we don't have like a hierarchical system as it is the case, for example, the Catholic system. In Shiism, of course, there is a sort of informal, unstructured hierarchical system of marja-i taqlid, meaning the source of the evolution.
And these are the ayatollahs, the Hojatollah Islams.
Exactly. But the thing is that there is no one single marja-i taqlid. There are always multiple marja-i taqlids. And marja-i taqlid doesn't have a very authoritative saying about other marja-i taqlid.
So there is a sort. There's also a situation whereby someone can be considered an ayatollah by their supporters, but not by their rivals.
Exactly.
As we see with Ibrahim Raisi, and as we see with the grandson of Khomeini, Hassan Khomeini.
Exactly. And this somehow manifests a sort of pluralistic system within the clerics. And I believe that the Iranian ruling clergy has brought a lot from their own internal interactions, internal relationship to the politics. And even during the Khomeini's time, which he was a very, very charismatic, he cared a lot for the high-ranking clerics in Qom. We have many documents, saying from him that asking his advisors, his politicians, to seek advices from Qom. I mean, for example, when they were drafting the Dagan Constitution in 1979, he asked to take the constitution to the marja-i taqlids in Qom. He didn't make the decision. And I think still that system continues in a way. And supreme leader, although he claims the highest power position in executive and all aspects of the politics in Iran, but still he listens and he doesn't make single.
He's careful. He's careful about what he does. Mm-hmm. Even his critics would definitely see that. The role of the office of the supreme leader, the head of state, he has the final say on everything, pretty much. But he also doesn't operate in a day-to-day way. And this is something that started under Khomeini, who himself, he was not really active in day-to-day, but his word mattered. Under Khomeini, who's a very different character, but he's been in for more than 30 years now. When Khomeini died in 89, and he shaped the office himself very much, but you don't see him on television every day. But if you're in Iran, you see his picture everywhere. So it's clear who's in charge. But when there are key disputes between different arms of government or between society and government, or when there are key issues in foreign policy, he usually weighs in and he usually gives the final word. And we saw this with Zarif this week. Just to fill in listeners, they may be already aware, there was a case last week where an audio was leaked of the foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is also a potential candidate in this election, in which he talked about the IRGC commander, Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in an airstrike ordered by Donald Trump in January 2020. In this audio, which was meant for an oral history, apparently, it was leaked to what the Iranian government would consider an enemy press in Iran International, which is a foreign-based or London-based organization. He made comments that through Soleimani, the Revolutionary Guard was running their own foreign ministry, basically, that they were running their own parallel foreign policy to their own agenda, and that this was undermining, that they weren't trained diplomats, they didn't know what they were doing, is some of the things he said when dealing with Russia, and that this was problematic. The Supreme Leader weighed into this. Now, before he spoke on Sunday evening, Zarif already issued an apology to the family of Soleimani, to the supporters of Soleimani, and to the entire Iranian nation. And then after he spoke, Zarif's words were very what you hear a lot, which is the Supreme Leader is the final word on everything. We thank him for his guidance. And it's always done in a very, it's supposed to appear in a very flattering way. He almost as a mea culpa, said, thank you for correcting my wrong actions, which is something that has, over since Rafsanjani's time, has increased and increased and is much more common with the Supreme Leader. But the overall point is, in the day-to-day area of governance, the Supreme Leader doesn't talk very much, but he does appear in periods like this and makes even if he speaks in ambiguous terms, everyone knows what he's talking about, who he's talking to. He doesn't name Zarif, but everyone knows who he's talking about. And he sets out, this is what has to happen, and that changes everything. And I guess to give the listeners an understanding of where the president sits in, the president might be going about his day-to-day business, but occasionally the Supreme Leader will come in and just say something, and that will stop whatever argument is happening because there's no going against it. So the elections occur every 4 years, and much like the American system, much like many other European systems, there's 2 terms maximum. This has been fairly stable over the past 40 years. The first president, of course, was impeached. The second president, he was assassinated very shortly after his presidency. But since that time, it's been fairly stable. Now, from presidency to presidency, we talked a little bit before about how the tone changes a little bit. So from Khamenei to Rafsanjani, we saw a change. From Rafsanjani to Khatami, there was a change. From Khatami to Ahmadinejad, and then to Rouhani. And often this is very noticeable to outsiders through their approach to foreign policy, particularly Rouhani coming in as the one to negotiate the nuclear deal, as opposed to Ahmadinejad, who was more about isolating Iran. The stability of the system is important, but also the process of how it happens. So not anyone can run for president. Not anyone can run for parliament. And the Guardian Council, which has kind of a senatorial role in terms of with the parliament in Iran. The parliament is called the Majlis, but it also vets all the candidates. It's very controversial when it comes to presidents, but also parliamentarians. Nasser, what are your thoughts on the Guardian Council and how it's fits within the political system?
Yeah, I think the Guardian Council, its name tells a lot about us. It's a guardian of the whole system. It sets the boundaries, and not for the legislation, which is the main function of the Guardian Council when it was created. The idea at the beginning of the when they were talking about the constitution was to have a body which monitors not the electoral procedures, but more about the legislation. So the legislation should be complying with the Islamic principles. And this was somehow inherited from the Constitutional Revolution 1906 as well. There was that five mujtahids should monitor the legislation in the parliament. And the early draft of the constitution was supposed to be like they step in whenever that there is a violation of the Islamic principles. Mm-hmm. But later they converted it during the deliberation.
And the whole idea is that you can make new laws to deal with new problems, but nothing can conflict with Sharia law.
Yeah. Not to violate any Sharia law principles or Islamic principles in a way. But the Guardian Council has extended its authority to the elections. And particularly there was a change in the second decade after the 1980s, particularly with the role of the Guardian Council in the elections. They take more aggressive role in terms of vetting system functions in a way that nobody can run election to the election because it's called Nezarat-e-Istesvabi. It means that the Guardian Council needs to make sure that it's not the benefit of doubt. It doesn't say that, okay, everybody are innocent unless that otherwise it is proven.
Yeah.
So it takes that we need to approve that you are eligible to run for the elections. And through this, they have ousted many candidates, particularly if you remember a former president, Hashim Rafsanjani and Ahmadinejad. Mm-hmm. And always it's the guardian of the whole procedure, how it goes and to what extent the reforming of the system could go. It sets the boundaries for the whole process.
And it's been controversial in the past 24 hours because they've had a fight with the Majlis for the past 6 months about a rule change, which they want with the presidential law, which essentially they want to make the law that only candidates could run between the ages of 40 and 75. This is the law that was, this was the rule that was brought in when they excluded Rafsanjani in 2013, but his supporters said there is no rule. So they have tried to change the law, but the Majlis didn't approve it. Yesterday they came out and said, we're doing it anyway. And this is just to give listeners an idea, this is specifically in reference to a particular candidate or believed to be about a particular candidate, Mohammad Javad Azadi Jahromi, who is part of the current administration. But this is an example of how the Guardian Council takes its authority a step further when it comes to elections, which is interesting for an unelected body.
Yeah, exactly. And the Guardian Council doesn't have the authority to legislative authority. It's a part of the legislation system, because it endorses the legislation by the parliament, but by itself cannot initiate any legislation. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of legislation because it sets criteria for the candidates, which should have been done by the parliament. And by this, I mean, already they are ousting two important candidates, including Tajzadeh, who is a very controversial reformist figure. And now, because of his criminal record, I mean, if we can call it criminal, because he was a political prisoner for a few years.
Just for listeners to understand, after the 2009 elections, he was in prison for about 7 years. Yeah. For supporting the protests.
Yeah, exactly. And the other important figure which won't be able to even register for the election is Mohammed Said.
Said Mohammed. Yeah. Because there is a rule that they say you have to have reached a certain rank within the military, and that Said Mohammed has not. Said Mohammed, just to let listeners know, is a popular candidate in some areas, because he has the Supreme Leader gave a speech last year saying that the next president should be a young Hezbollahi, meaning a young devotee of the system, basically. And Said Mohammed has styled himself this way in a very way that's. It's familiar in terms of 2005 and Ahmadinejad. He's an IRGC guy. He's young and youthful. Even though he's 52 years old, he appears quite young. But he's been very controversial. Some parts of the Revolutionary Guard have said that he was fired and hasn't resigned, that he's unethical. And in this case, it's believed to be that one of the rules in the Guardian Council will exclude him. Before we finish this section, just to say a few more things about this. The Guardian Council also is controversial for excluding women from running for presidency. Now, since 1997, women have always nominated. But there is this term, Rajoli Siyasi, which is controversial, which the other day, actually, the spokesman from the Guardian Council, Kad Khodai, he came out and he said that we do not discriminate against men and women. Women can nominate just the same as men, and they're judged against the same criteria. But he still didn't clarify this term, because that could mean that men are judged as not being women, and women are still judged for being women and excluded. We can't really talk too much about this today. We'll talk about this in future episodes, but that's something that is also important in this discussion. Just to finish this section, we just want to talk about some of the key dates. So next week, on May 11 to May 15, is when the nominations will take place. And after that, they will announce about 2 weeks later, on the 26th and 27th of May. Then we have, that's when the vetted candidates will be announced. After that, there's a period of about 3 weeks where there are campaigns. There are, people tend to travel around the country and rally. We don't know if that's going to happen to the same extent because of COVID, but Ahmadinejad, who won't probably be there, he's already started doing that quite vigorously. And there are also electoral debates and electoral campaign videos. And then there's a blackout just before the election, and then the 18th. There is a prospect of there being a runoff election, because usually how it works is one candidate clearly wins and there isn't a runoff election. But if they get less than 50% of the vote, then the two highest polling candidates will have a runoff. That's only ever happened once, from my understanding.
Yeah, during 2005 elections Ahmadinejad and Hashim Rafsanjani.
Yeah, so it's unlikely, and that really speaks to the system itself, and we don't know how votes are counted and everything else, because sometimes you see a candidate gets 50.1% of the vote or something like this. We don't know. But
yeah, and at this stage, we cannot say anything, because I think it will make a big difference who is eligible to run, who the Guardian Council let to run during for the elections. So when we know the final candidates, then we can have more accurate idea of, or at least a speculation in a way, what's going to happen if it's kind of one person going to be won the election in the first round, or there will be the second round if there's no very, important figure running. Yeah.
That's right. It's not very predictable at all. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk more about the issues that are going to come up in this election and a little bit about the candidates. listening to the Iran Election 1400 podcast. I'm Dr. James Barry, and I'm here with Dr. Nasser Robotzadeh.
Yeah, James, I wonder what you think of the key issues. What are the major problems right now that you think that will have impact on the election process and during the campaigns particularly will bring up
This time around, I mean, the economy is always important to Iran, and the economy is always bad in Iran, but this time it's very, very bad. I mean, I haven't seen it like this before, but COVID in particular Iran has been hit very badly by this and how it's been handled. And this is one of the issues that comes into election participation, because people are, on one hand, expecting that there's not going to be a big turnout. Yesterday there was published, or 2 nights ago, published on by the IRIB, the broadcaster, that a poll that said that less than 50% of people would want to turn up because they're afraid of their families catching COVID. But also this comes into a whole other issue, that there is this belief that when election photos go up, if there's not a good turnout, that the government puts up photos from previous elections, that this can't happen this time because everyone's wearing masks. So that's an important issue. But how this has been handled and how the economic situation is being handled is definitely coming up. And it's both sanctions and corruption, key issues that I see again and again in what people are talking about. I mean, it's been a terrible 4 years for Iran. There's been protests in Iran, very violent protests in Iran. With the death of Soleimani, they had some capital, which lasted very briefly until the shooting down of the plane, the Ukraine. But I guess one of the things that the Rouhani administration is really pushing towards is finalizing this nuclear deal. Because if they get that, then the idea is that suddenly the pressure will be less, and that the system, well, people will think things are improving, even if they're only doing so slowly.
Yeah, I agree with you that the negotiation will matter during the elections, particularly if it continues. I mean, if there is no deal up to the election time, which is less likely nowadays, I think it will be a part of the campaign by the candidates, that they will play with the negotiation card, that obviously those running on the reformist platform, whoever he is or they are, they will play with this card so that we can get a deal with the U.S. and we can get over the sanctions. One thing that I was thinking is that the Supreme Leader didn't want this negotiation to be a part of the election campaigns. That's why he, just a couple of weeks ago, he said that we don't want to long negotiation process. I mean, get the deal as soon as possible, otherwise walk away from the negotiation.
Yeah. Yeah, and he might say that, but it's very hard to separate the two, considering especially candidates and potential candidates are all talking about what their economic plans are. The whole issue of the elections themselves having an impact on the sanctions. The sanctions are is interesting in the case of Mohammad Javad Zarif. We're not going to talk too much about him, but he has always been saying, I'm not going to nominate for president because I've still got this to deal with. But he's got a double-edged thing there, because he should nominate if he wants to get the best out of it and hope for the best that it will, the sanctions will be lifted, or there'll be hope of them being lifted, significant hope of them being lifted during the campaign. That will boost his rating. So the politicization of the sanctions is a very big part of this.
Exactly. And there is a major question, an important question about the reformist generally, reformist camp and faction, about their chances of, it doesn't matter which candidates with whom they come to the elections. What's your thought on that, different camps, how they are going to manage the elections? What are their chances, particularly the reformist camp?
So as I see it, and you might disagree with me on this, I mean, the reformist camp has not come up as very strong this time. The reformist camp, for those who don't know, is associated with the presidency of Mohammad Khatami. This is where that first the term was used. They're kind of I see them as all sitting in a right wing of the political spectrum. The group that are known as the principalists, who are their rivals, are more hardline. They're more strongly right, whereas the reformists sit in the center right. And in between are this group that call themselves moderates, which really former hardliners who've slowly made their way towards the center for practical reasons. The reformists have kind of shown that they're not really expecting anything from any of their own, because, for instance, they put out a list of candidates this week, and number one, number two were both members of this current administration, Mohammad Javad Zarif and Ishaq Jahangiri, both of whom are not reformists. So they don't think that their own can really get up. And this is similar to previous times. I mean, I think 8 years ago, their own guy, Arif, they forced him to stand aside for Rouhani, even though Rouhani is not one of their own. I mean, I'm not sure how you see the reformist camp, but they look like they don't even believe in their own group.
Exactly, and I think that's a big dilemma for them, because they have tried that way of negotiating with some, I mean, what, as you correctly mentioned, moderates, to get some sort of the share in the pie of the power in the country, but it has proven counterproductive in a way. They have lost their reputation, and people hold them accountable for the current situation, because they were the ones who supported Rouhani. And even before that, during the parliamentary election, the previous parliament, they supported many moderates. And even in the experts, Khobragan,
they supported experts, the principles. Which is another part of the Iranian system, yeah.
Exactly. But they didn't gain anything from the support of the moderates. So they need to, I think, a significant part of the we know as a reformist camp, they are not happy with supporting a moderate candidate, but a candidate from moderate, or even some of the Usul Gerayan or principalist conservative camp. That I mean, someone like Larijani is a candidate, could be a candidate that they could negotiate to support.
Well, they have put his name forward before. Exactly. And he's someone who was, Ali Larijani was a former Speaker of the Parliament until 2020, he was a Speaker of the Parliament. Someone who's kind of groomed as this supreme leader's choice of the more moderate but still conservative candidate. But the reformists are even like, he's too different from us to be to be supported. Like the reformist camp is very divided between the two. And also Mohammed Khatami himself seems to do a lot behind the scenes still about governing decisions that they make. So it kind of turns into a little bit of a, there's some who believe it's just a cult of Khatami in some ways. But the principalist faction, the Usul Gerayan, they definitely see this as their election. This whole pendulum swing that before it was under Khatami, it was reformist. Then it went to Ahmadinejad, conservative. Then it went moderate, and now it comes back to us. Yeah. And their candidate, well, their ideal candidate, who hasn't nominated as well, Ebrahim Raisi, he is a favorite. Where do you think the principalist faction is going in this election?
Yeah, they have their own problems as well. I think that if they can convince Ebrahim Raisi to run for the election, then they will stand in a better position, because I mean, Raisi will be supported by many factions within the Usul Gerayan, within the principalist. But if Ebrahim Raisi doesn't agree, I mean, someone like Qalibaf or Larijani, I don't think that they have this, they can have the support of the many factions. They will be divided, and maybe there will be a few candidates running for the within the Usul Gerayan camp, which will be a problem for them as well.
Yeah, and Mohammed Bakr Ghalibaf, who is the current Speaker of Parliament, the former mayor of Tehran and former Revolutionary Guard as well, I believe, he has a he kind of has a feeling that he doesn't want to be second choice. You get that feeling from the conversations that are, the rumours that are happening. So there is also a risk that if Raisi doesn't run, he won't either, because he doesn't want to be the second choice. Before we finish, one other faction that's really emerging is the Revolutionary Guards, this idea of a military candidate. That has been controversial this time because of Saeed Mohammed, who we talked about earlier, but also other candidates. Are you seeing this as a particular faction that's coming into the Iranian political scene, or is already there?
I have a bit of different opinion about the Guardian Corps and Sepah Pasdaran and the whole of the discussions coming that they are taking over the whole country. My view is that, I mean, when we talk about the army or the military taking over, we need to identify individuals who has the authority to give orders, to who has the authority to somehow to be in charge and control of the army. But what happens is that in everybody that we know as coming from the Guardian Corps, I mean, except Qasem Soleimani, who had this, I mean, reputation as well, who he could be the person who would be able to play a significant political role. But with the others, individuals from the army, it doesn't matter from the army or the Guardian Corps, I mean, they are just replaced very easily by the supreme leader. Supreme leader. I don't see an independent role, political role for any of the individuals of those who are from the army. I mean, for example, Firuz Abadi was the head of the joint army for, I don't know, 30... some years,
and
just one a few sentence by the supreme leader, and he's gone. He's nobody now. And I don't see anybody else in the army, Saeed Mohammed and Qalibaf, who is in charge of the army, who is able, for example, if necessary, if his interests, his political faction requires, to ask army to come to the streets to do a coup. I mean, it's the supreme leader who is controlling the army.
Yeah.
And it's very evident and obvious from the just replacing people within the army very easily. I mean, Mohsen Rezai went away, Jafari went away. I mean, all of them. The only figure that I think that was capable of having his own political independent role was Qasem Soleimani, who's no longer alive, obviously.
Okay, well, thank you for today. Thank you for joining us today, Nasser. We'll hope to see you again soon.
Thanks a lot, thanks.
Just letting you know, for next week, we're going to talk a bit more about the nominations, because there will be the beginning of the nominations. And on the 7th of May, there will be Quds Day, which is, of course, a very big event in Iran. It's the last Friday of Ramadan. This is the day when there is a massive protest in favor of the Palestinians, but it's also a politically important day. The Supreme Leader will be giving a speech at 11 a.m., and his speech, no doubt, will have something that he will have comments to say about the election. Please don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IranVotes1400, and also on our website, mesf.org.au. And also, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you next week.